Okay, so yes, we've been doing quite a long seminar based on a paper published by Subbuti, one of our most senior teachers in the Tri Ratna order, and who's also the president of this centre, who visits us regularly, and it's the paper he's written on a suprapersonal force. It's called. So if you're interested in that paper, you can find it on Subbuti's own website. That's the background for the seminar. What that means, hopefully, will be sort of come to life in what I'm going to say this evening. And so tonight and next week are the last two of the seminar. And I was saying that each one hopefully stands alone as well. Although I would like to say that this week and next week are a kind of pair. So yes, so I hope you'll be able to come to both of them. When I was thinking about what I wanted to say this evening, inspired by Subbuti and Bhante Sangharaj, I felt like there was so much I wanted to, in a way, sort of try and channel, as it were, from them to you. So it'll probably take me 2 weeks to do that. So, okay, so what Subbuti's addressing, but in a way this is what the whole of Buddhism, you could say, the whole of the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha are addressing, or trying to get us to see, is that what we take for ourselves, what you take for yourself, what I take for myself, isn't the be-all and end-all of existence, yeah? There's a whole other dimension of experience that's more real than our everyday experience, but it's very hard to get a sense of that. And the reason that it's hard to get a sense of it is because, well, in a sense, most of the time all we have is our experience of ourselves, so how are we going to get beyond our experience of ourselves with ourselves, yeah? There's a sort of central paradox of the spiritual life, that we're... that there is a reality beyond the normal sense of self, which is characterized by self-clinging, by self-protection. There is a reality beyond that, but how can we access it? And yeah, so as I say, that's what the whole Dharma is trying to address itself to, and that's what Subbuti's trying to look at in this paper. And the way Subbuti's done it in the paper is he's looked at Sangharakshita's life, Sangharakshita, Bhante Sangharakshita, as a person whose life seems to show that he has accessed that. The sort of demonstration of his life seems to show, and Subbuti gives examples of when he thinks he particularly that manifests in Sangharakshita's life. A life that's been moved by something more than its own conscious volition, by something bigger than its own conscious volition. Yeah. So what Subbuti does is he takes Bhante Sangharakshita, he sort of uses that as a starting point, and he says, well, how has he done that? What are the key elements that have sort of led to that? And he isolates, or he highlights, I should say, three main things that he thinks were present in Sangharakshita, that are present, that are conditions for this. So I wonder if anyone can, who's either read the paper or has been at the other seminars, can remember or even guess what those three things might be, as exemplified in Bhante's life, but could be exemplified in anyone living a genuine spiritual life. So can anyone remember, even hazard a guess, at least if you were to pick three things that were the conditions?
Meditation.
Okay, so meditation, yeah, is a sort of subset or one of the conditions, yeah.
Practice, then.
So when you say practice...
Practicing meditation and ethics.
Yeah, good. So the sort of formal Dharma practice, as it were, and that would be the practice of meditation, Dharma study, practice of ethics, yes. So that's one, formal Dharma practice, brilliant.
Okay. So being something bigger than yourself, so having a project that's more than to do with your own personal development.
Yeah, so that's it. And that's sort of the overarching term Subhuti gives is serving the Dharma. So serving something bigger than yourself, but that's very worthwhile, yes? Yeah? So, and in Sangharaksha's case, that would be serving the Dharma. And third one, I'll give you a clue, we had it last week for anyone who was here. Anyone here last week? If you were, you're not owning up to it. Or anybody who wasn't here last week like to guess. So we've got formal Dharma practice, serving the Dharma. Now what's the third?
Well, supporting it as well.
Mm-hmm. Supporting the Dharma, that would come on, that is true, and that would come under serving the Dharma, yeah. So that would still come under the second.
Faithfully practiced with, or were taught by?
Yeah, well, I think we'll allow that to we'll allow that to cover that. So the third one is lifestyle.
Yeah.
So the conditions of your life, so in Sangharaksha's case, it's particularly a renunciative lifestyle, a lifestyle that's always looking to be more and more sort of simple, be more and more less acquisitive. Yeah, and last week we looked more generally about what types of lifestyle, for example, what type of livelihood we were engaged in, what kind of conditions we were putting, maybe what kind of living conditions we were putting ourselves in. So there's lifestyle. Yeah, and that's, you know, in a way it's... It sounds obvious, that one, but not to be underestimated. The principle being that actually we're much more conditioned than we often give credit for. How we spend our time, what we spend our time doing day in and day out, say in terms of a job, who, you know, the people that we surround ourselves by, like friends and people we live with, have a massive effect on us. Sort of one way or the other, in a way. I mean, again, that you could say that's a principle of going on retreat, to sort of our coming to the centre is trying to be in conditions that are hopefully positive. So that's the three. And I'm particularly going to be looking a bit more this evening and next week about the serving the Dharma one. Which we've touched on already in this seminar, but there's so much to say on it, I thought it's worth another few weeks on it. And I want to particularly look at a sutta, an ancient text, going back to the time of the Buddha, called the Garava Sutta, that sort of, I think sort of helps to open up what this serving something bigger than yourself could be. So, and actually I thought it was appropriate as well, because we've just had Buddha Day yesterday. So yesterday we were celebrating the Buddha's enlightenment over 2,500 years ago. And what did the Buddha do? So when the Buddha, he was enlightened, tradition tells us, under a tree, under the Bodhi tree, which there's still a sort of, I don't know what you call it, not offspring, bit of the tree, from the tree, still in India on that spot. What did the Buddha, after his enlightenment, what did the Buddha do in sort of immediately after?
Did he walk?
Did he walk
for a long time?
He walked. What did he do before he walked? He did walk eventually. He sat there for quite a long time. Supposedly he sat there for 7 weeks, yeah? He sat under that tree for 7 weeks absorbing the experience, and then he did go walking and teaching.
That was
leading up to his enlightenment, and then on his enlightenment he became enlightened under the tree, and then he sat there for a long time absorbing the experience. And one of the things that occurred to him was the sort of substance of this Garva Sutta. So it says, so the Sutta says, when he was newly self-awakened, when he was still alone and in seclusion, this line of thinking sort of spontaneously arose in his awareness. So he thought something very interesting. He thought, one suffers if dwelling without reverence or deference. Now on what Brahman or contemplative can I dwell in dependence, honouring and respecting him? So here he is, he's the Buddha, and yet he's still thinking, who can I revere, even who can I obey? And he's saying, if you don't have anything to revere and rely on and even obey, it's a source of suffering. So what do we think of that? Do you think that's true in our experience? Do we need someone or something to revere and rely on, and is it suffering if we don't have that?
Surprising.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Very surprising.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that before.
Uh-huh.
And I would have thought that you were trying to free yourself from that.
So right. Yeah.
I don't know whether it's true that you
do. Okay. So it's do you find it particularly surprising that it's in the Buddha? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that is surprising, isn't it? Yeah, well, I find that surprising to hear. Yeah, so for any other, so that's good, great to have that response. So any others? So there's the Buddha. What about us? Do we need people to look up to? Do we need that? When I asked you earlier if you had somebody to look up to, did people think of someone that they did naturally look up to on the whole? What would it be like if when I asked you that question you couldn't think of anyone that you could look up to?
That's what happened to me.
That's what happened to you, yeah. And what was
like, it? The trouble with that is that it's like trying to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps if you don't have a model or a guide.
Yeah.
Which is... it's a hard way to go back.
So when you say that's what happened to you, is that what happened to you now, if you don't mind me asking, that you couldn't think of anyone, or was that...
You're saying that's
associated with difficulty for you. Do you wish you had?
When you said that was surprising, doing it is kind of obvious, right? But it's
okay.
I mean, is the equivalent of trying to pull yourself up by hand? Everyone has something inside them that they, in crisis, that they actually, sort of look to. The people put this in all sorts of language, archetypes or whatever, and that kind of thing. And if when you're in real trouble and you look for that voice, that image, that figure, that whatever, it doesn't necessarily have to have a form, and you don't find anything, there's nothing there.
Okay.
It's, you know what I mean?
It's hard, yeah, okay.
But it doesn't have to actually be, I think it would be like an amalgam. It doesn't have to actually necessarily be
one single person.
Yeah, exactly. But they need to be. It's a strange way to go about things to not have people to look up to.
So that's great, isn't it? And then, so let's take it a little bit further, because we've got the sort of situation that you describe when we're in trouble, if we need somebody to look up to, and there's nobody, even an amalgam, that's painful. What about if we're not in trouble, as it were? Because presumably the Buddha wasn't in trouble. He's just like, what about even if we weren't in trouble? This is just to take what you're saying deeper, not to sort of go against it.
I think a lot of the time I don't want someone to look up to.
Okay, yeah.
Sometimes I just want to learn how to do it on my own. I think actually a lot of the the culture that I, you know, the West here in London is telling me actually learn how to be self-sufficient. And quite like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't want to depend on anyone. That's, I don't want to place my faith in anything that's not, you know, I can't, I don't know, I'm getting into dangerous territory now. Do you know what I mean? I'm wary of anything that might look like a god, I guess.
I'll come back to you in a second. I just want to respond to Jeff, and also I just want to, for the sake of the recorder. So you're saying you like being independent. You sort of fear being dependent, maybe a little bit like you said, and you're particularly worried about him that looks like a god. Yeah, you want to do it alone. So just to take that a little bit further, when you say you want to. What I'm thinking is, even when you say you want to go alone, there's still an it. There's still a sense of there's something beyond where you are.
Right.
Yeah, you know. So even if it's, so I think that might be included in this. That there's still a, there's still some. It doesn't sound like you're thinking, I'm not looking up to anyone because actually, I've arrived.
Yeah.
It's something that's still a sense of somewhere. Further to go, is that?
Yeah, but I'm also saying.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would trust anyone to help me get there.
Okay, so that's good. Okay, and then we'll take your comment. Then I'll move us on a little bit.
I was just saying, the bit didn't look up to or aspire to anybody, did he? He just came about his views and opinions completely by himself.
He didn't. Yeah.
So what we've got is kind of like a variety of different beliefs that we can sort of choose from, rather than I don't know if it's about looking up to somebody, is it? It's more about what resonates with you, I guess, and what feels right.
Well,
being told what to do by a god or an other.
Well, it could be. But what's interesting here is that here's the Buddha, and as you say, the Buddha, in a sense, did do it on his own. He had some help on the way, but in the end, he surpassed everyone. But yet here he is, if we're to believe this sutta, here he is saying that even me, enlightened, if I don't have anything, anyone, if I can't find anyone to revere and rely on, it's a source of great suffering. So here we've got the Buddha. I mean, we could just say, oh, that sutta is rubbish and we don't believe it. But if we are to believe it, this is what the Buddha says. So that seems like a bit of a paradox, doesn't it? That here's, you know, which I think some of you are picking up. So there's the paradox of how can a Buddha say that? And then there's a bit of different opinion in the room. Like some of us kind of fear this idea of, oh, we might get dependent on somebody and treat them as a god. And then there's the other side of, oh, if there is, it sounds like you're more resonated with the pain of not having to, you know, yeah. So that's quite good. So I enjoy having that sort of, well, these two different poles. So what, I'm going to press on a bit, but, you know, I might not have time to discuss every point, but you can disagree with me in the innards of your mind freely. We're going to come to that. Yeah, hopefully. There definitely was it as a next bit. So, what Subhuti says, and again, no need to, you know, you can, I'd be absolutely free to ponder this in your own experience. So, Subhuti goes more, he resonates with a painful aspect, and he says, if you can't look up to something, it's deeply painful because there's just you. And he says that in the end, that's an unsatisfying state because you're left with all you're left with is your own ego identity. And what Subhuti says, he says, this is the hell of atheism. But as we know, there is no God in the sense of creator in Buddhism, so there's no God either. In the same talk, this is another talk that he gave on the order convention, but you can access it easily again on the web. He says that's the hell of atheism, and he then quickly says there's the hell of theism as well. Yeah, so you've got the hell of theism on one hand, and you've also got the hell of atheism as well. So what we're trying to do is find a middle way, because this is presenting us with another paradox. And he says that, but being left with that just you, that that's all that is, that that's the kind of best you've got in a way, in Subhuti's opinion and experience, and he's very frank about his own experience in this talk, he says it's limited and dull and heavy. And he says as a human being, he thinks you must have something beyond your own ego identity. And that even the Buddha, and he's very struck by that in this sutta, it seems to be that even the Buddha felt this, that there must be something beyond your own ego identity, or else you're, that itself is suffering. Not that you're going to suffer, if there only was your ego identity, that in itself would be suffering. And as a matter of fact, if there was only your ego identity and that wasn't suffering, well, that's great then, isn't it? Because you could all... Because in a way, we would be there, wouldn't we? If it wasn't suffering, we wouldn't need to bother about anything. Because we're just... I mean, that's the state we find ourselves in, on the whole, sort of consumed by our ego identity. So if that wasn't suffering, well, we wouldn't need a path or anything to follow. There's a bit of neglect in this little sutta. Sangharakshita has particularly drawn it out. So I hope what I'm going to say next might start to fill it out. I hope I've got enough time to say it all this week, but you'll have to come back next week. So the Buddha goes on to say something that you might find even more paradoxical. The Buddha goes on to say it would be for the sake of perfecting an unperfected aggregate of virtue, i.e. ethics or sila, that I would dwell in dependence on another Brahman or contemplative, honouring and respecting him. And he goes on to say, it would be for the sake of perfecting an unperfected aggregate of meditation, of wisdom, of freedom itself, and of knowledge and vision of freedom. So if we were puzzled before, we might be even more puzzled now, because like you might think, like he's meant to be the Buddha, like he is meant to be the perfect one. That's how often the Buddha is described, as the perfect one. So I thought for a start we might look at this notion of perfection. So this might help us to unravel this little seemingly paradoxical little sutta. So I think what's important is, so we do talk about the Buddha often as the perfection of the human. I mean, we all know, I think, that the Buddha was born a human being. Through his own efforts, as already been said, he attained the state of awakening, of enlightenment. You could say that he perfected what it was to be human. But what this doesn't mean, even when we say the Buddha's enlightened, it doesn't mean that the Buddha has reached some sort of end point. because if you think of the notion of perfection, you could say, and this is paradoxical again, that for something to be perfect, by its very nature, it has to be reaching beyond itself. It has to be constantly transcending, or else it's not perfect. So it has to be being continually being reborn, which means there's actually no such thing as static perfection. So you could even say, to be really paradoxical, that for something to be perfect, it has to be imperfect. Do you see what I mean? Because if you say it's perfect, by perfect, it's got to be constantly self-transcending. If it says it's static, then it's not perfect anymore. Yeah. So even in a seminar I was reading discussion with Sangharakshita from years ago, he talks about this, and he says, well, you can't really say there's room for improvement in a Buddha. He said that would be a bit too far. But what he does say, he says there will always be room for further expression So I think this is starting to get to the T, I hope. It makes sense to me. And so there's always room for further expression. And I think what this is getting at, and I think why Sankaracharya is particularly emphasising this, is because another thing that Banji's constantly emphasising is that enlightenment isn't something you have. It's not something that you sort of can own or possess, or even, in a sense, discover in a sort of static way. You know, I always think it's a bit like, you know, when you... you know, you put your winter coat on, you haven't worn it for ages. I always think, oh, I always have this little fantasy that I'm going to like suddenly find a £10 note in the pocket, you know, that I'd forgotten about, that I'll have had all along, you know. But that's not really what enlightenment's like. It's not like something you kind of think that you had and you forgot, and then you find like this £10 note that never materialises anyway. Because that's too static. It's much better to think of enlightenment as a way of being, and of something that's, and that way of being is essentially responsive. So it's, I like to think of enlightenment as a state of constant creativity. So it's not, as I say, instead of thinking of it as an end point, you could think of it as the furthest point of the horizon of our imagination. So it's as far as we can see from now. And in terms of our own spiritual life, what Buddhism would say is our own spiritual life has always got to be pointing beyond itself. That the total process of it will always be unfinished, even when we're a Buddha. It'll still be unfinished. And what I thought I'd do is I'll read you two little snippets from two poems that I like, because I think sometimes this can be better expressed in poetry. And I think poets are quite aware of this unfinished nature. So here's a little... so here's a little poem from Norman McCaig, a Scottish poet. So he says, it's from called July Evening. So he says, something has been completed that everything is part of, something that will go on being completed forever. So something has been completed that everything is part of, something that will go on being completed forever. So I think that gives, I don't know, I think that gives that lovely sense of that paradox. It's been completed, but it will be being completed forever. So I think that must be what enlightenment's like. It's complete, but it keeps being completed forever. And here's a similar sort of vein from Thomas Tranströmer on being human. He says, don't be ashamed to be a human being. Be proud. Inside you, one vault after another opens endlessly. You'll never be complete, and that's as it should be. So don't be ashamed to be a human being. Be proud. Inside you, one vault after another opens endlessly. You'll never be complete, and that's as it should be. So I think this non-static nature of enlightenment, this kind of constant creativity. I mean, you can see it in the life stories of the Buddha. You know, in the Buddha's life, you get these encounters between him and various people. Many of you will know the stories. And I think what Banti emphasises is these are dynamic encounters. You know, so we've got very famous classic tales of the Buddha meets a grieving mother, Kisa Gotami, and he responds in a particular way. But it's a dynamic encounter. It's not that he... It's not some sort of stock response he calls up. Like, that meeting will call out of the Buddha a particular response. You know, then he, you know, if he hadn't met her, or if he'd met another different person, another response would be drawn out. Do you see what I mean? It's a dynamic, responsive thing. You know, he meets a mass murderer, Angulimala. That encounter, sort of, something in the encounter happens where the Buddha comes out with this tremendously creative response that results in, you know, the conversion of this murderer to the disciple of the Buddha. But again, it's not a sort of these calling up some stoic response. It's not that he kind of goes, oh yes, this is my mass murderer response. Something I imagine would have happened in that moment that comes from that state of sort of readiness, you know, and that's what I call the state of creativity or responsiveness. And I think the more I've been sort of appreciating Sangharakshita, I've been particularly appreciating this aspect of what Sangharakshita has drawn out for us all along. I've been writing a book recently, and it's great exercise writing a book because it really calls on you to really study the Dharma and actually really think about it and think, what am I trying to say and convey? And I was reading a lot of Bhante's teachings, and I felt like every now and then I think, I know what he's been trying to tell us. And often I'd have that in response to the particular emphasis that Sangharakshita has made of, for example, the positive precepts. A very, very simple sort of notion we've got of the positive precepts. So all Buddhist traditions have chant the five precepts. Most of you will be very, very familiar with them. And we chant them in this tradition, Tri Ratna, we chant them in their negative and their positive forms. Now, the fact that we chant them in the positive forms is something that's that's something that's particularly found in her tradition. So you find them in the negative form, I undertake to abstain from taking life, etc., all over the Buddhist world. But the positive form, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body and so on, that we're particular in chanting them. You'll find them in the scriptures, and you'll find them listed, but you won't find them emphasised in the way Sangharakshita has emphasised them. And I think he's not just doing that to kind of say, oh, look on the bright side, you know, it isn't. I think he's doing it for a much deeper reason. Well, I've started to appreciate the deeper reason, I think, for this, and I think it emphasises this unending, infinite scope, yeah? Because if you think of the positive precepts, you've got with deeds of loving kindness, how could there be an end to loving kindness? How could you ever be so kind that you could never be kinder? Or that kindness could never take a further expression? Even if you were enlightened, there'd always be room for further expression for that. With generosity, contentment, truthfulness, mindfulness, you know, they're unending, aren't they, the expressions of them. And I think that's something very kind of, there's a very deep meaning to that. And I think the meaning to it is this notion that nirvana, that enlightenment, isn't an end point. Here's something that Bhante says in his most recent publication, Living Wisely, which I thoroughly recommend as a Dharma book. He says, if we think of nirvana as a fixed point, however subtle or sublime, to which we may attain and of which we may take possession, we're really thinking of it as a glorified ego state. So, in other words, we're making a mistake to our own detriment. And then he says, it says in like nirvana, it's not like it's some sort of spiritual retirement home. He says, far from the maddening crowd of suffering humanity, where we can settle down to enjoy our well-earned pension. He says, nirvana is not a destination at which we arrive. It's the life of enlightenment. I love that, actually. Nirvana is the life of enlightenment, a way of living, a process of perfectibility, to which you can see no end. So it's the actual way you live, the way you have your being, when you've gone beyond the limitations of conditioned consciousness. He says it's a term used to designate the unlimited nature of the process of growth and development. So that's, anyway, I get very excited by all that. I get very excited by that notion of perfection not being an end point. And also what I want to explore further this week and next week is how perfection not only isn't an end point, but it's not something we can do individually. But let's go back to the Buddha. Right, so here we've got the Buddha saying that one suffers if dwelling without reverence or deference. Who can I look to? And he says, as you may even have guessed, he says, I do not see another Brahman or contemplative more consummate in virtue than I, on whom I can dwell in reverence and deference. Yeah? And the same for, he doesn't see anyone more consummate in meditation, wisdom, freedom, knowledge, of the knowledge of freedom, the knowledge of release. So actually he doesn't see anyone, but he's still got the, he's still got the longing, the need, you know, the, so he says, what if I were to dwell in dependence on this very Dharma, this to which I've fully awakened? And that's what he does, that's what he decides to do. He, but that, in a sense, will be the thing he looks to, the Dharma itself. So when we say that, so when we talk about the Dharma in different ways, so we talk about the Dharma as teaching, but again, that's not quite what he means. He doesn't mean that he's going to dwell in reverence of the Dharma as teaching in terms of just the sort of words of it. After all, in a sense, it hasn't been taught yet because he's the teacher of it and he hasn't started teaching. So how Subhuti puts it, he says he means, again, something that you can experience. It's like the Dharma as truth itself. But again, we need to remember that that's something that's dynamic. It's not something you statically observe. It's not that you're here and you kind of think, oh yeah, there's this truth somewhere and I'm going to look up to it. It's something that begins to move within you. It's a dynamic force. You know, we often talk of the Buddha as the awakened one, as someone, as the, that's what the name Buddha means, like someone who's awake. But in a sense, you could equally say, you could say he's woken up to the truth, but you could equally, in a way, say the truth has awakened in him, you know? So it's like something is wakening up through you, it's something dynamic, yeah? So, okay, so that's the classic text, yeah? So that's the classic Garbha Sutta that some of you may even have heard. But Subhuti got very, very excited recently, as he's wont to do, because he discovered another text, still just as ancient in a sense, but it's the Buddha looking back. So this is, and he's describing, he's looking back on his own experience. And he says the same first bit. He says, oh yeah, I was sitting under the tree and I was thinking to myself, who am I going to revere? And I couldn't see anyone, so I decided to, or realised I'd have to revere the Dharma as truth. But then he added in a bit, and this bit is the bit that Subhuti got very excited by, and I'm now excited by. He said, and once the Sangha came to greatness, I lived relying on that. So what does that mean? So once the Sangha came to greatness, so what is the Sangha? And what, and in what sense did the Buddha rely on the Sangha? So the Sangha's talked about in different ways. So it's talked about generally as the collection of everyone practicing. And it's also talked about, there's also the Arya Sangha. So the Arya Sangha means other enlightened beings. Yeah? So the disciples of the Buddha, for example, when they became enlightened, and then men and women down the ages who have become enlightened. So Subhuti looks at, well, what does the Buddha mean when he says, I've lived revering and relying on the Sangha? He says, well, who does he mean? And he's quite quick to point out, he probably doesn't mean us. You know, he probably doesn't mean us as we are. And he says, well, the classic answer would be these enlightened disciples. But interestingly enough, Subhuti says that he thinks, although that would classically be the right answer, that he thinks that's too schematic. So he thinks he means more than that. He thinks he's talking about Sangha as living experience. Yeah, so we had the Dharma as something dynamic that flows through us. He says, well, there could be something where you could have sangha as experience. Yeah. So he says it's kind of He says so you've got the Buddha in a sense as you've got the Buddha as just the being, the person who's awake, but you've also got the Buddha as kind of the sort of archetype of awakenedness, yeah? So that's reflected in an individual, yeah? So you've got this kind of force of awakeness reflected in an individual in the Buddha. And then you've got the Dharma as that force of awakeness experienced internally. And then you've got the Sangha as that force of awakeness experienced interpersonally, yeah? So, I mean, to bring that kind of more to something that we might have had a glimpse of, which I think you've probably all experienced, I imagine you have. I've just, you know, referred to a little chat I was having in the tea break. I was having a little chat with Lotcha in the tea break. And Lotcha was saying, and I know she won't mind me saying this, she was saying that, you know, she comes to the centre every Monday night, and more often than if she can. But she says, oh, I wish I could come every night. I wish every night was a Monday night and I could come to the centre on a Monday night. She said, she says that she meditates every day. Lord, she meditates every day at home. But there's something about coming to the centre and meditating all together that something else happens. And I can see she was saying, oh, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's something, yeah? I mean, do other people... Is that an accurate way of putting it, Lodger? Or, yeah, and do other people experience that something? And, you know, we look around at each other and we're kind of, well, you know, we're trying our best, but we're kind of, here we are, kind of motley crew, you know, probably all getting, you know, probably if I had to ask you all, did you get distracted in your meditation? We might even all say yes. I did. I got distracted in my meditation. Did other people get distracted in their meditation? Yeah, most of us got distracted. So there we all are. We all got distracted. But yet, between us, we sort of somehow produced something that we're all saying that we felt we could experience. Yeah? Would that be too far-fetched to say that, true? We can't prove it scientifically, you know, but at the same time, we're all saying we experienced that. So what is that? You know, it probably isn't any of us individually, or in a sense, even us collectively, if you to add up our experience, and you know, but at the same time, it's not separate from us, you know, because it wouldn't have happened if we weren't here, yeah? So this, I think, so that's what Subhuti is saying, that he thinks the Buddha was saying that he could come to revere and rely on that spirit of Sangha. Subhuti calls it Sangha Kaya. Kaya means body. So the sort of body of Sangha, yeah? Or embodiment of Sangha even. Something that happens when people come together and practice, or even make the attempt to practice the Dharma. Something happens that everybody contributes to and that everybody can partake in, yeah? Whew. So, what else do I want to say about that? Okay, so I'm going to try and just finish it off now. I'm sorry there haven't been more time for questions, but I've got a whole lot even more. Do come back next week and there'll be more time for questions. So, okay, so we're going back to this. So what we're trying to do with Buddhism is we're trying to have faith that there is a state beyond ego clinging, that there's more than just this kind of hell of atheism and materialism when it's just us. And we're trying to find a way of accessing that. In itself, we're sort of been exploring that it's an unlimited thing we're trying to access, but also it's very hard to access it because we're trying to go on beyond ourselves with ourselves. And one of the ways we can access it is by serving the Dharma, but you could also say, we could equally say that we could access it by serving the Sangha. And also, it's not just that we access it by serving the Sangha, that serving the Sangha is the very character of the thing we're trying to access in the first place, yeah? Maybe just think about that, because I think that's quite, I think that's something to quite ponder on. A simple way to say it is that if we want to go beyond, if we want to access this state that's beyond ego clinging, this sort of spiritual rebirth, if we want to be reborn in a state beyond ego clinging, what we could do is, we could concentrate on trying to create the circumstance in which that arises, but in a sense not be too bothered about in whom it arises, yeah? So we could try and create between us a sort of culture where growth and development just becomes natural, and then we don't need to be so bothered about, is it going to be in me or is it going to be in you? Because as soon as we start bothering about, is it going to be in me or you, we kind of kill the very thing we're trying to do, because we're back to self-reference, yeah? See what I mean? Yeah? So, there's a really good lecture on TED Talk. Some of you might have heard it, by this author called Elizabeth Gilbert. It's on Genius. I really recommend it, Elizabeth Gilbert on Genius. And she's, in a way, she's got a different kind of question in mind. She's kind of, her starting point is looking at the sort of psychological health and sustainability of being an artist. So she's coming from somewhere different than we're coming from necessarily in this talk. But she still comes up, she still, in a way, what she talks about is quite relevant. So she talks about how it's only relatively recently that we've talked about genius as something that individual people possess. It's only since the Renaissance, it's only in the last 500 years. She says in ancient Greece and Rome, people believed that creativity was a sort of divine attendant spirit that came to human beings from a distant and unknowable source for distant and unknowable reasons. Yeah, and that's how we used to all think about creativity until 500 years ago when you started to talk about a genius. And she says, well, it's psychologically dangerous. She says it's like asking somebody to swallow the sun. And she sort of says, well, why not go back to more of that ancient understanding? She says, well, it might not seem very credible to us with our scientific, rationalistic minds. But in other words, but on the other hand, she says, why not? Why not think in terms of genius as something that's this divine attendant spirit? And in a way, she says, well, it makes just as much sense as anything else she's ever heard. She says, she's saying, well, anybody that's ever tried any creative endeavour, and you could include meditation in that, knows that it is sort of maddening and sort of capricious, you know. But, you know, it doesn't behave rationally. I mean, meditation's a bit like that, isn't it? Sometimes when you think you're going to I'm going to have a good meditation now, I've set up all the conditions, it's awful. And then other times, you can surprise yourself, you're in the most terrible mood or the most terrible, and then it's almost like something comes through and you're suddenly, something lights up. But then have people experienced that? That it's, So she's just sort of encouraging us to just think, well, why not? Why not think of it like that, as something that isn't so much ours, but something that comes through us? And then she talks, she gives the example of, she says, centuries ago when she talks about the North African dance, when people used to have these moonlit sacred dances, music that would go on all night. And she says, well, they were always magnificent, the dancers were brilliant. But she says, every once in a while, something would happen, and this would be quite rare, that on top of the ordinary brilliance, she says, one of the performers would become completely transcendent. And she said, it was like time would stop, and the dancer would sort of step through a kind of portal. And it was like he wasn't doing anything different than he'd ever done, that he'd done for a thousand nights, but it was like everything would align. And all of a sudden he would no longer appear to be merely human. He'd be lit up from within and all on fire with this divinity. And she said when that happened, people would start to clap and they'd start to chant, Allah, Allah. And she said, interesting enough, that's where we get Olé from. You know, when in Spain, when a performer's done something sort of impossible, something magical, something beyond human, you've got sort of bravo, you know, that glimpse. And it's like a glimpse of God. It's like something, something beyond, yeah? So she says, as a writer, she started to sort of call on that spirit. In a sense, she does her job, the writing, but she sort of calls on that spirit. But also, I think it's interesting that she seems to also suggest that that spirit's even more likely to come through in the collective when she's talking about, you know, these dancers. You can sort of almost sort of see that as she describes it. I remember that myself. I'll just sort of finish with a little example of that myself, where I felt... I'd gone on the first ever 3-month women's ordination retreat. It was so exciting because we'd been fundraising for years for this property searching. People had given loads of money, time and labour here. We finally had the place. All the women turned up that were about to be ordained and they were absolutely full of gratitude. The atmosphere was so positive. And we were about to spend 3 months on retreat together, and not only that, in the midst of it, I was doing the cooking to support these other women that were going to become ordained. So highly, highly positive. And I remember just looking around at every day, and I was thinking, gosh, you know, maybe somebody really will transcend themselves on this retreat. And in the exact same moment, simultaneously, I had the thought, and it doesn't matter who, you know, and that felt so true. It wouldn't have mattered who. I mean, you know, I don't know whether they did or not. But I think the interesting thing for me was it wasn't relevant who, you know, if anyone did, that would be wonderful. You know, I wasn't thinking, oh, I hope it's me, you know, or it probably won't be me, it'll probably be her. There was nothing of that was in it. So that's what... that's what serving the Dharma and serving the Sangha could mean. So it could mean just play our part in creating a culture where everyone's efforts are made smoothly and naturally. This would be a culture imbued by the Dharma, and this would be the character of what we're trying to achieve as Buddhists. And then if we did that, if we really did it, we would solve the problem of that individualistic will. Each of us would be using our own sort of little bit of talent or little modicum of talent for everyone's benefit, which might be like just making the tea. Do you know what I mean? It might be just speaking kind of kindly and not harshly. You know, it might be when we're meditating, sort of somehow not getting too self-conscious about it, but realising actually we're creating this for each other. You know, in a sense, we're creating light for one another. And so that's, you know, that's a sort of another reason to practice. It's a sort of finely tuned thing, because if we get too self-conscious about it, it sort of won't work in a sense. All we have to do, really, is be wholehearted. In a sense, all we have to do is kind of forget about all this, really, and just be wholehearted. But don't forget it completely. So maybe they're the two main messages for tonight, that perfection isn't... that enlightenment isn't something static. Perfection isn't something static, and neither is it something individual. Well, that's what I'm sort of putting out there for you to ponder. And I'm going to talk about all this more next week. So if you're interested, please do come back. Hopefully there'll be a bit more chance to ask some questions. And I've gone over by 3 minutes, sorry. But hopefully see you next week. Thank you. Thank you.